Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 201, I chat with industry consultants Mike Heiss and Chris Armbrust about what we saw and heard at NAB 2014. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 10th, 2014. Episode 201, NAB 2014 Wrap-Up. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by NatureBox, where you can order great-tasting, healthy snacks delivered right to your door. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like Cherry Berry Bonanza. To get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week, I have two guest geeks on the show. All of us have just been at the NAB show in Las Vegas, and we've all just returned, and boy, are our arms tired. seriously, folks. Both are industry consultants who scoured the floor for interesting information. We have much more than we can talk about in an hour, but we'll get to as much as we can. First, there's Mike Heiss, industry consultant that I have had on the show a number of times. Hey, Mike, welcome back.
Hi, good afternoon, Scott. Thank you for having me on the show again.
You bet. And for the first time on the show, Chris Armbrust. Pardon me for massacring your name, and thank you for correcting me, and welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
You're actually coming at us from the TWiT studio, since you live so nearby, and so you're in glorious high definition.
Yeah.
And do appreciate you making that effort. You actually got in today, didn't you, from Vegas?
I literally got off the boat. I got off the ferry and ran home and got in the car and drove up. So,
man, well, we sure here. Do appreciate that. Yeah. If it were me, I'd probably want to just collapse, but...
Well, I'm still on Las Vegas time.
You know, wait a second. Hey, listen, those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for us as we go, and I will pass along as many as I can. I do watch the chat room as we progress. If you want to catch my attention in the chat room, be sure to use my screen name, Scott Wilkinson, all one word, no dots or dashes. That will show up in a different color on my display, and my eye will be more easily drawn to it. So, we have an awful lot to talk about here at from NAB. I would say the first and most important thing, certainly what I was looking for and what was not at all difficult to find, was 4K or UHD, ultra high definition. This is what the broadcasters and all of the content creators are talking about pretty much nonstop. There were a couple things other than 4K, but that's what we're going to concentrate on today. And one of the presentations that I saw was very interesting. It showed kind of the roadmap of the development of UHD and when and how it's going to be rolled out. And we have a graphic called UHD phases, I think. It's going to come out in phases, so they say. And let's take a look at that. And Mike, give us a sense of what it is we're looking at here.
Well, and the most important thing is it's going to come out in phases, but one of the recurring themes also was that there's no mandate here. This isn't the same type of thing we had 5 years ago when there was a date certain, analog TV was going to be cut off and everything would be digital. These are proposals, but it's important to note that there's really no time attached to them, but we're arguably, because there's nobody really driving the bus, but we're arguably in phase one now. There is some 4K or 3840 by 2160p content. It's mostly in 420. It's for now mostly in 30p. It's mostly in 709. It probably doesn't have HDR or high dynamic range, and it's mostly in 5.1. And we'll probably be stuck in that for the most part for about another 2 years. Concurrently with this, there's a development going on called ATSC 3.0. That's the American Television Standards Committee. The folks Advanced Television Systems Committee. Those are the folks that are driving another part of the standards activity. And this ATSC 3.0 may be what the FCC would at some point approve for terrestrial broadcasting, but they haven't sorted it all out yet. And that phase two is what we'll probably begin to see when that gets codified. But then it won't get implemented, one of the vendors told me, until kind of about 2019 or 2020, when the Olympics are in Japan.
Right. Now, let me just quickly go over, you rattled off a bunch of terms there that some people might not be all that comfortable or familiar with. 420 is a form of data compression in which a lot of color pixels are thrown away. And we would like to see that decreased because it does affect the image quality. High dynamic range refers to the difference between the darkest part and the brightest part of the image. And this is a very important thing regarding how the display looks, how real the image looks on the display. You also mentioned 8-bit, which is the representation of dark to bright, is 8 bits, encoded in 8 bits currently. And we would really, really very much like to see higher number of bits. The other thing I think you might not have mentioned was color gamut. Frame rate is another one, Chris. Thank you very much. Frame rate is how many frames per second are being shot. Movies are at 24. Video, current TV is either at 30 interlaced frames or does ABC do 720p 60 or 30?
They do 720 30p on ABC and Fox. CBS and NBC are 1080i. It's the whole thing of temporal resolution, which is the frame rate. And if you remember in that one session, the fellow, not from Harmonix, I forget where the guy was.
I think it was
from.
Erickson.
Yeah. And he was really pounding the table for temporal resolution as being key over spatial resolution, which is the 4K thing. And I would certainly agree with him, because if you step, as I know you've said many times, if you step more than a few feet back from the screen, you're not going to see the resolution. It's there, but it doesn't make a difference. The temporal resolution, the high dynamic range, the extra color depth, all of that, you'll see that. In fact, the best quote, I don't remember if you folks mentioned it, who were at the Hollywood Post Association tech retreat, there was one guy who stood up in one of the sessions at the end and said, 4K is great. It'll finally give us great 1080.
Yeah, one of the Canon presentations yesterday was showing off how they could use the 4K displays or 4K cameras and then do a center crop and move that center crop around in a 2K so that they could have something really nice to edit with in some cases just doing a single camera shot.
Exactly. Oh. And many people also made the point that shooting in 4K, or yeah, 4K, let's call it, allows sports in particular. You can zoom in on some action or piece of detail there and see that very clearly in 1080p. Whereas if you shot in 1080p and tried to zoom in, it wouldn't look very good.
And that's in use now. I think 16 4K cameras at the Super Bowl. You didn't see them in 4K, but you saw them through the replay systems.
Right, exactly. Chris, give us sort of an overview of your sense of the 4K UHD at NAB. I mean, it was everywhere.
Yeah, it was you know, I look at trends over the years. So like last year and 2 years ago, and it's like, where are we going with, you know, what's coming and what's coming next? You know, so 2-3 years ago, we were all looking at 3D. Last year, a bunch of hype about 4K, but not much product. And then this year, 4K is all over the place. For the, you know, everything from cameras to displays. I was surprised in just, you know, you walk the booths and you see, and it's like, oh, there's another 4K display. There's another 4K display there.
Yeah.
And then also the HEVC. The other thing I saw was kind of a subtle difference between CES emphasis and NAB emphasis. At CES, it wasn't 4K. It was Ultra HD. At NAB, it's all 4K. Not, and a few references to UHD.
Yes.
I thought that was an interesting difference in emphasis because, you know, there is a difference. And the CEA has declared that from a marketing point of view to go to UHD. And
for the consumer. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I think, Chris, the production guys are really into 4K because they're also looking at the cinema side.
Yes.
And I think that's just one of the reasons for that.
Yeah, no. I thought it was interesting because it's like, well, and then what does 4K mean? Because some people are doing 4K, but they're really doing, you know, 420, or they're doing it in 8-bit. They're not doing it in, you know, they're not doing it in 422 or 444. And, you know, are they doing it in 10-bit or are they doing it in 12-bit? So, and then, you know, and then there's the resolution and then there's the frame rate. So it's like 4K covers a lot of territory, and you don't really know. I mean, you have to ask the questions to find out, is this the flavor of 4K that I need or want?
But the before you
go on, Mike, I want to make sure everybody understands the difference between those two terms. They're so often used interchangeably, and it drives me nuts. But I have to accept it. We all have to accept it because the manufacturers, even the TV manufacturers like Sony and Samsung and Panasonic, even though they're making displays that are technically Ultra HD or UHD, they're calling them 4K. And this causes great confusion. Chris, take us real quick through the difference between 4K and UHD.
Okay. So it's a simple case of, math, but it's when you go to high def, you've got the 1920 by 1080. And basically, so if you're making panels for consumer displays, you're making panels in that resolution. To up it to you know, four times that, what you're going to do is take that and double the 1920, double the 1080, and, you know, I'm in front of the camera, so what is that, 3860 by, or anyway, I always get that goofy.
3840 by 2160.
But exactly. Right. Okay, now, 4K is 2048. Not 1920. So when you double
you
that
mean
up,
2K.
The 2K is the 2048,
right? Which is a cinema standard. It's a professional standard. It's not for the home.
Yeah, and when you double that up, you know, now in HD, there's not that much difference. There's what, less than 100 pixels difference. But when you double it up for the 4K or the Ultra HD, now those numbers start to diverge a bit more.
Right.
And so anyway, so you got more bits with the true 4K.
But one of the things that plays into that a lot of the people were talking about is that the images are captured in the raw format so that then you can grade it out however you want. And it's the same thing with the resolution. That is it, you know, cinema mask. This is like a Joe thing. You know, how do you chop it up?
Right. I want to talk about cameras a little later, but you brought up an interesting point about how they're capturing raw. Some of them are. The Red digital camera does. The Sony's apparently can, but they don't have to. And let's talk about that in a minute. For the moment, I do have a question here. QNX Monkey in the chat room is asking, how many pros were there pushing 444 32-bit? And do they think broadcast is ready for it, or will there be a bandwidth limitation and they just have to use 8 or 10? Well, I didn't see anybody pushing 32-bit.
You didn't talk to Joe.
Actually, I did talk to Joe, but we didn't talk about that particular question. Joe Kane, by the way, is who he's referring to, who's been on the show a number of times and will be again. He is the video guru of all gurus, and I'm sure he'd be very happy for 32 bits, which would give you tremendous dynamic range. The number of bits or the bit depth really determines the dynamic range.
Scott, though, this is where I wanted to bring in the fact that I saw a great presentation on Saturday morning, which was part of the SMPTE program, on basically the future of cinema. But the first session that they had was on the human visual system. And so it's like, what can you perceive? And, so you've got spatial and motion
High
dynamic range. You've got all of those. And there was a gal from the UK, her name was Dr. Jenny Reed, and she is not coming at it from an industrial point of view. She's coming at it from a human perception point of view. Uh-huh. And so her whole thing was, well, what can you see? You know, and so she's done lab tests of, you know, can you perceive that difference? And she rated four different areas, but basically saying, you know, do we need 8 bits or do we need 10 bits? And her take was, for what the human eye can see, that 8 bits isn't enough, that 256 differences isn't enough, that the 1024 steps gets closer, but really what you need is somewhere, and her number is actually, because she's doing it from the test, not doubling, you know, the numbers.
Right.
But her number is about 3,000 3,000 gradations that you can tell
of brightness between dark and at darkest and lightest parts of the image. If you go beyond 3,000 gradations, the eye can't see the difference anyway.
And what that turns into from a camera point of view is it turns into about a 22 step of resolution that you can
22
see. 22 stops, excuse me. And that where the camera's at, and this is kind of the state of the art right now, is about 14. So there's actually more to grow. Most displays right now, I believe, are at like 6 or 8.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So
that's correct.
So we've got, you know, it's like, what can the human eye see? What's the state of the art in the technology? And what are we able to display on people's screens? And it's, you know, we've got a disparity there, yeah.
And how big is the pipe to shove all of this through?
That's the minor detail.
Which was another one of the big... the second part of the Kunix Monkey's question was 8 or 10 bits. And in that phase diagram, it seems to be going towards 10 bits in phase 2 and 8 bits now.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. I want to also point out in this diagram, while we have it on the screen, Phase 1, which we're currently in now, which is 8 bits, which is the current range of colors or color gamut, which is 420 color subsampling, which is what we use now, is on track to be completely implemented by 2016. And only when we get to 2018, the year 2018, do we see 10 or 12 bits with a wider dynamic range and a wider color gamut. And not till 2020 do we see even 8K. And we're going to talk about 8K in a little while here, because that was something else that was at that NAB. But what the point I'm trying to make here is that we're still a ways out from fully implementing this UHD or 4K in the consumer environment anyway. Now the professionals are talking about it big time, as we saw at the show, but it's going to take some years before what they're doing and these other parts of UHD get sorted out and finalized. This was one of the things I wanted to make sure we talked about, was standardization. You know, we have a standard pixel resolution, spatial resolution, 3840 by 2160. But we don't have a standard dynamic range. We don't have a standard color gamut. We don't have a standard bit depth or frame rate that everyone has agreed to use for UHD. And this really, to me, poses a problem, especially for people who are buying 4K or UHD displays today. Mike, what do you think?
I agree, and again, as we've talked, and there was a lot of discussion at NAB, and then there's audio, and then when you get the transmission, there are different codecs. And all of these things are going to make this a big puzzle until somebody, maybe I think in my mind, the biggest question is who's going to set the, there are standards, there are just too many of them. And who's going to be the arbiter that says, right, okay, this is the set of standards. And I don't think you can say it too often that we didn't have to worry about that the last time around because the government was driving it. They're not, they got other problems now.
Well, Michael, you had earlier you pulled up the your King card, and where this is all driven from is it doesn't matter, you know, how many
content
bits you have,
king,
what kind of frame rate you've got, unless the artists know how to use it and know that they can use it and have it be delivered, you know, delivered to the consumer. I saw that
right
too.
And the Joker. So, yeah, he's definitely a Joker.
Yeah, and so it goes back to, you know, you've got these human perceptions of, you know, what can be seen, and then how does the artist or the content creators, how do they want to use that? And then, you know, as a, you know, the rest of the industry is like, okay, let's put the standards in place so that we can deliver those tools and effects that the artists want to use. And I've always looked at this as, you were earlier talking about Mourier on one of the patterns, and it's like, okay, was that an artifact or was that art? Okay,
it's always a good question.
Yeah,
and also how these things all mesh together to go from 709 to 2020 is not going to be easy or graceful, and I would certainly hope that you might be able to address that a little bit from your experience, but 2020 is great. You'll finally be able to see New York yellow cabs in their real color. But 709 content doesn't play well in a 2020 system.
Chris, what's and again, just to make sure everybody understands, 709 is the range of colors, the color gamut we see now. 2020 is the range of colors that most people sort of hope we get to, but it's very difficult to get there. It's a much, much wider range of colors, much greater range of colors that, as Mike said, will represent the true New York yellow cab, the true red double-decker bus in London, the true IBM blue, none of which can be represented accurately in our current color gamut. But if we go to 2020, or a slightly less than 2020, which is called DCI P3, which is what you see when you go out to the digital cinema. But again, there are all these standards, like Mike said, and it's like, which one are we going to choose, and who's going to make that choice? I learned at NAB that, and I sort of knew this already, that SMPTE more or less is the governing body amongst the professionals, while CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, is more or less the governing body for consumer electronics. And they'd better get together on this, or we could have a mismatch, and that could be a real problem.
There is quite a bit of a collaboration back and forth between the two standards committees. Because mm-hmm. It's like, well, we need this, and how much do you need, and how are we going to do it? I mean, one of the issues right now is even with HDMI 2.0, you know, we're capped at 60 frames per second, and
right,
and yet when I go back to human perception, you've got human perception where you can actually see up to, in some cases, there's some edge cases, but you can actually detect 250 frames a second. And so if I'm to make this picture, you know, go away so that I can get a more immersive experience, at some point in time, we need to address that. Now, is that in these, you know, phases of UHD? You know, probably not. I don't know that, you know, we've got enough bits or enough algorithms to be able to pull that off.
That's another interesting point to make sure everybody understands, is that when we're talking about higher dynamic range and wider color gamut and greater bit depth and higher frame rate, we're talking about putting more and more data through the pipe from the camera, through the production process, and then finally to the home.
Some of the camera shoots that we're talking now are going up to, I think it was 160 to 180 gigabits a second.
Yeah.
Okay. And we've got AT&T advertising high-speed internet at 3 megabits a second.
And that'll right. be the big test for the people that do have 4K sets with HEVC decoders now that are able to watch House of Cards. And there have been reports. I haven't seen it yet. Scott and I will hopefully be able to see it next week at Joe Kane's house. But there have been a lot of, at least in the blogosphere, people saying that the thing is choking and that it really isn't. It doesn't look as good as you would expect, perhaps due to bandwidth limitations.
Yeah, I got a chance to look at that, just a clip, a Netflix clip advertising in 4K at the Sony booth yesterday afternoon.
Yes.
And it's amazing because at a you know, more than about 4 or 5 feet, the picture looks pretty good, and then you step into it, and it's like you don't see micro blocks, you don't see macro blocks, you see micro blocks. They're little pixels, and it's like, oh, I can see them, but they aren't too bad. And then they did a Netflix transition where the Netflix box comes up and then it goes away, and that totally pixelated. It's like, oh, come on, you know, a 2-minute loop and their logo screws up.
I asked the guy in the booth. I was standing right in front of the same demo, and I said, "Was this live streamed from Netflix?" And he said that the first Sony 4K sets didn't have HEVC decoders in them, so that was sort of a bit of a fudge. It really wasn't playing the live content because it couldn't receive it.
Yeah.
Right. Now, this brings up a very important and major part of what I wanted to talk about today, which is the delivery of UHD. Whatever the format turns out to be, whatever all these elements or aspects of it turn out to be, it's going to get we want it, obviously, to be delivered into the home in some way. And there are three possibilities there. One is over the air, and we might call that terrestrial or... even OTA. Satellite, OTA. There's coming in by wire, which would be cable, or more likely IP, that is over the internet, online. And then finally, we have physical discs, which like Blu-ray, but would contain this much greater amount of information. Now, IP, in my opinion, internet delivery, is obviously going to be the first method by which this content comes into the home. It already is starting with Netflix. We saw that. You guys, when you went to that Sony demo, I went to it as well. You saw that Cisco was demonstrating a live UHD feed from New York to the NAB show, to the Sony booth, over Time Warner's dedicated IP backbone. It wasn't over the public internet, and it was streaming, they said, at 15 megabits per second. And I thought it looked pretty good, didn't you?
And it was 60p, but it was the news set of someone in New York, and they weren't moving around a lot, so it was, hard to tell. But the video was really clean.
Yeah. Didn't you think so, Chris?
Yeah, no, that was amazing. It almost looked like a picture with, you know, because he was literally mousing around.
You know? Right, so. Right, exactly. And you could see exactly what was going on. But that was, and it was 60 frames a second, which was really, really good. But there wasn't much motion. It was very relatively easy thing to encode and transmit. The other thing I found out, from end to end, from the camera to the display in L.A., from the camera in New York to the display in L.A., 15 seconds of latency, which is a lot. And so they're working on getting that down, but that's one of the issues that has to be addressed, because this new codec, which is the compression algorithm that the video get and audio get encoded into before they get transmitted, called HEVC, high efficiency video coding, is the next generation, which everybody seems to be latching onto. It's also called H.265. What we use currently for high definition is H.264, called AVC, or advanced video coding. And HEVC is supposed to deliver twice as much efficiency. That is, cut the bandwidth and storage requirements in half compared to AVC or H.264. Now, we found, but it's much more complicated. And it takes a lot longer to encode and therefore causes a lot of this latency. speaking of codecs, as I mentioned, it's supposed to deliver 50% greater efficiency, twice as good efficiency. But that really isn't what we're getting, practically speaking, is it? Chris, did you see anything on that?
A couple things on that. One is, so as codecs have a life cycle, so I started with MPEG-1 for a video codec, and actually before that. But in the early days of MPEG-1, you know, not so good. MPEG-2, the first encoders that we did for, you know, that I used for DVD, we had releases coming out with better implementations of the encoding, in some cases weekly. In the early days of AVC and H.264, we saw the same thing where you get the content and some content, like I was saying about the Netflix logo, it's like, well, that didn't look good. How can we change the algorithm to do that better? And so you see lots and lots of improvements in the encoders in the early days, and that's where we're at with H.265. The whole thing with the coding is you've got an encoder and a decoder. The specs are how to read a decode, but there's no spec on how to read, how to create the encode. It just has to be in a format that everybody can decode it. But what that allows is everybody to be very creative about how they do that. That's why there's a lot of competition in the software encoders, the hardware-based encoders that are now just in the chipsets. And so anyway, there's a lot of activity in that area. On H.264, the AVC encoder, we are now, 7 years into that encoder?
Yeah.
And there are still, I know of at least two groups, maybe three groups, that are still making improvements in the encoder. And in fact, you know, one of the groups that we saw there was Beamer, where they've taken and done an algorithm for AVC to make, they were applying it to HD content, which is because we got a lot of HD content right now. We don't have a lot of Ultra HD content. But they were taking it to that, and they're getting 20 to 30, you know, plus percentage increases. And that's with the existing encoder.
Actually, you know, they do work with HEVC as well. And I have a picture that I just want to show everybody, difficult to see, called Beamer. B-E-A-M-R is the name of the company. And you're right. They're mostly showing HD content encoded with AVC or H.264. But they did have one clip with Ultra HD encoded in HEVC. They are encoder agnostic, they say. And if we can see that photo, I can show you exactly how much they were. It's called Beamer, B-E-A-M-R. Oh, don't have it. Oh, I didn't send it to you. Doggone it. I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, it was about 50%. Now, with HD content, it was less. It was about 30% typically.
Yeah, which is the same efficiency that H.265 is claiming.
Correct.
Although what the Beamer people were saying is, or Jeff, is that it's actually a preprocessor because they're applying their secret sauce to the content and then feeding it into the HEVC decoder. So it's almost a two-step kind of thing. It's not a delivery to the consumer mechanism in and of itself.
Yeah, that's what I was saying earlier. Is just it's the, you know, you've got the encode and then the decode. And the encode part is where Beamer's playing, and they're making the encode smaller. And we have H.264 decoders all over the place. Every box set tops through the digital media players all have H.264 decoders, and they can all handle these more cleverly encoded H.264 streams.
Right, sorry, I was going to say, Mike, real quick, that what Beamer is doing really is they developed an automatic measurement, if you will, of image quality. And so what they do is they take the file and they encode it at a certain bit rate and they compare it with the original, the file that came into their system. If there's no visible by this measurement, change, then okay, let's crank down the bit rate a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more until finally, yes, this would be visible. You'd be able to see that this is worse. Okay, crank it back up to the next bit rate up, and that's the bit rate we're going to deliver. And it turns out that that can be less than what most people think of as acceptable. Go ahead, Mike.
No, just a good example of how that works in real life is that CBS was very adamant for the past couple of years about not running auxiliary channels in their HD signals because they didn't feel the encoding was up to throwing those bits away. And anyone who has a CBS-owned station now, if they view it over the air, there is a sub-channel. And I asked Bob Seidel, who's their head of engineering, about that. And he said the encoders have improved enough to the point where we could squeeze it down enough and fit more channels in the pipe. So the same thing is definitely going on here.
Yeah. The other company that's doing this that I wanted to mention for sure is Faroujia. Now, you guys both remember Faroujia. Yves Faroujia is a legend, really, in our industry. He was there in the standard definition days, deinterlacing
what was then
called line doubling, and doing all kinds of video processors that are still used today. He has kind of been a little out of the loop for a little while, but he hasn't been resting. He's been working really hard on, again, another way to reduce the bit rate that needs to be used in order to transmit ultra HD or even high def. And I have a picture there too of hopefully of Faroujia display. There it is. He was showing a very complex scene here in ultra HD at a bit rate of about 6 megabits per second. Which is starting to get into the realm of reasonableness for online delivery. And even more interesting, I took a really, really... See the guy standing there? Those of you who aren't watching the video, please forgive me. But there's a picture of a guy standing in a sort of a brick way. And next to him, on his left, there are two lamps, two little wall lamps. And they're basically red with white polka dots. Now, if you translate or go to the next image, which is the close-up, called the close-up, Faroujia close-up, you will see there's some moiré on the screen. We were talking about that earlier. I think that's because of the relationship between the pixels in what's getting sent out from Twit and the pixels on the screen here. But he was quite impressed to see, as I was, that these little white dots on these lamps, on these lampshades, are actually very well resolved at 6 megabits per second. So he was doing something pretty interesting too, and he's agreed to come on the show, and we're going to talk to him at another time to learn more about this, and also talk to him about his remarkable career, which I'm sure you guys are both very familiar with.
But the catch is that's an encode decode system. Whereas
Correct.
With Beamer and some of the other things, it's a preprocessor, it goes in the pipe, and then anything can decode it. The catch
Correct.
For the moment with the Eve system is it's more like a mezzanine thing. You need his box or chips on both end.
Or software.
Yes.
Yeah.
great. Well, listen, you guys, hang on for just a second here, because we have a new sponsor on Home Theater Geeks, which I would like very much to thank. For their help and even for what they do, because believe me, it's a product that has become near and dear to my heart. It's called NatureBox. Now, NatureBox is it's a company that provides really, really good snacks. It's easy to talk tough about eating right. I do it all the time. But when you're starving at 3 a.m. and you're all cranky and lightheaded, that evil vending machine down the hall can really, really look mighty good. But don't give in. Keep your eye on looking and feeling great and head on over to naturebox.com/twit. You click on the continue button to choose between three subscription options and then place your order. It's a subscription service that comes to you you know, once a month, and you can select things that that conform to any dietary needs you might have, like vegan, soy-free, gluten-free, lactose-free, nut-free, non-GMO. And you can also select by taste, savory, sweet, or spicy. Now, I myself am really digging the chili lime pistachios. These are mighty fine. They also have, I'm almost done with my Fuji apples, dried Fuji apples here, and the Italian bistro pretzels. Really, really good, let me tell you. I am the king of snacks when it comes to eating around here, and it's a struggle for me to find snacks that I can feel good about. And boy, I think I've really found something seriously good here. NatureBox sends you great tasting snacks right to your door with free shipping anywhere in the U.S. Now, we're talking healthy and satisfying snacks like barbecue kettle kernels, French toast granola. I haven't tried that one yet, but I certainly want to. The chili lime pistachios, as I mentioned. Over 100 more, all with zero trans fats, zero high fructose corn syrup, nothing artificial, which is just the way I like it. Now, NatureBox is the snack happy gift that keeps on giving, so I want you to remember that as well. Order a 3, 6, or 12-month subscription for that special someone, either friend or family or both. Now, swimsuit weather is almost here, so it's time to snack smarter. Forget the vending machine and get in shape with healthy, delicious treats like honey mesquite almonds. Haven't tried those yet either, but you can bet I will. So remember, to get 50% off your first box, go to naturebox.com/twit. Stay full, stay strong, go to naturebox.com/twit. And we thank NatureBox very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and of my snacking. So we've been talking about codecs. We've been talking about bitrate reduction, which is really, really important, as all so much more information is going to be coming down that internet pipe into your home for UHD. Do either of you have any sense of the progress on physical discs? Blu-ray has been talking about it and saying we need to come up with a new physical format for UHD or 4K. And either of you have any sense of how that's going? They're pretty tight-lipped about it, and I didn't hear anything at the show.
Yeah. I know a number of people on the BDA and
Blu-ray Disc Association.
I'm sorry, yeah, the Blu-ray Disc Association, which is the group that makes the it's a consortium that puts together this spec. And it's I don't know how many companies now, somewhere between, I don't know, 50 and 80, maybe even more. Mm-hmm. And everybody has a vested interest, and so it's in the end, people know what needs to happen. I mean, when we talk about these bit rates, putting that bit rate on a Blu-ray disc is no big deal,
right?
And it's like, well, it may take up more space. Well, you know, currently Blu-ray is at 2 layers. We've got, you know, Blu-ray could, you know, there've been things done in the lab where they've taken it up to 16 and 20 layers. So there's room to do that, and it's not too hard to go to a third layer, which would give you 50% more capacity. So physically, the disc can do it, and most everything is there. But it's whose IP is going to go into, whose intellectual property is going to go into the spec, and therefore have a particular share of the royalty pie when, you know, they sell all these discs and all of the players. From what I've heard, it's a difficult process. I mean, if you can imagine sitting around a table with 100 of your closest friends, including 20 to 30% of them being lawyers, it's like, you know,
not to mention being competitors.
They try to be co-opetition, because again, if there's no pie to share, it doesn't matter.
Right.
But at the same time, everybody wants their slice to be biggest.
And some of those guys really don't like each other on a corporate standpoint. There's harsh feelings left over from some of the last battles. This one will make the time it took to get HDMI settled, look like it was instantaneous.
Yeah. Well, and they've got a window, because, whereas technically, they could have done something. I mean, you can put on a Blu-ray disc ROM, you can put Ultra HD, 8K, you can put that on there today.
Sure.
As ROM. Now, how are you going to play it off? That's a big deal. In the in over-the-top services with like Netflix and Amazon, that's no big deal because they control the whole ecosystem, and they can turn it on. You know, it's like if somebody hears it, you know, somebody's putting a service out in 4K, you can turn around the next day and do the same thing. You know, at least
right,
from an announcement
exactly.
point of view or a technology demo point of view.
Sure. But internet delivery, online delivery, just simply can't match the quality of Blu-ray. And I know certainly on avsforum.com, the vast majority of people are going to say, give me a disc because I want the highest possible quality. And that's not going to be for some years yet, is it?
And there's also throttling. I mean, one of the other things that...
Yeah, good point.
You're going to hear this brought up as the Comcast-Time Warner merger buyout is in the news more frequently, is the concept of throttling. And if people are not satisfied with the results from this House of Cards demo that's going on now, it could set things back a little as well, just from the bad press.
Well, and the throttling also comes about from not just a malicious, you know, we're not going to let Netflix's bits go through. It also comes about from some practical limitations of the ability of the internet to expand. I was listening to a couple of different presentations by folks from Akamai, who are the CDN or the last step where they cache all the bits for the movies local to you, so that you don't have to pull them all the way from the central point. And they're saying that they're growing year to year 8x times.
Mm.
And with Ultra HD coming out, they see that accelerating. And they already are representing 30% of the traffic on the internet. If they, you know, so you do 8 times 3, okay, and how fast is, you know, how fast can we light dark fiber? And the numbers just they don't add up.
A snowy Saturday night, and everybody's watching 4K Netflix, you're going to blow it up.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard somebody say in one of the presentations I saw that one of the reasons that high-speed access is relatively expensive is because they're actually trying to discourage people from using it. If everybody in the country had, you know, 50, 60 megabit download speeds or 100 megabit download speeds, the internet would crash. It couldn't sustain that kind of volume.
Well, and then but you also, I mean, this is a very US-centric situation, because in
yes.
other countries, I mean, and you hear this is the backstory on the floor is, you know, there was a announcement in several sessions where they were warning the foreigners or the guests from international who'd come in that you may experience slow internet this week.
That was an understatement.
Yeah, it was terrible. But
certainly in my hotel it was horrible.
Yeah, but the fact is, even in the homes, I mean, I'm getting right now the service I have with Comcast is at 30 megabits down, and that's almost it's almost archaic compared to what I can get in my hotel in Taiwan or in Taipei.
Right. Right.
There's also there was another bit of backstorying along the same lines, that one of the reasons that people were suggesting that Netflix did their deal with Comcast was to get closer to the end, to get, you know, behind some of these problems in the CDN.
Mm-hmm. That might be a good name for the company, the merged company, Netcast.
The next merger.
Yes, exactly. Taylor Karras is asking in the chat room, is it possible to get 4K content compressed to fit onto existing discs, or would that require a new medium? And, Chris, you were mentioning before that you certainly could. It's technically possible. It's just data.
Yeah, well, it's just data. I mean, right now, I pay attention to the bits, and a 1X Blu-ray disc runs at 40, and if you're doing DVD, excuse me, if you're doing 3D... You take that 40 and you're going 80 megabits a second. And that's basically still about a 1x, 2x times. The calculations I've done on how fast you can spin the disk say that you can spin it about 8 times before the outer speed is too fast. But if you go 8 times those, you've got a lot of bits there that you can pull off the disk. Mm-hmm. And there are players out there that play at 8 times because the BD-ROM drives are the same as the drives that end up in the consumer units. The other piece of it is, do I have enough room on the disk? And again, currently you've got 2-layer at 50 gig, and if you double that or triple that, the disk are and the technology is there, and the path is there if they can decide the rest of the specs on it,
right? But, which is where all this bitrate reduction comes in. Really, it becomes very, very important, not only for online but also for storing data on a disk, whatever the disk happens to be, whether they modify Blu-ray or come up with something different. One of Beamer's arguments is that, hey, we can use this on 1080p and Blu-ray and reduce, if you buy, say, a season of a TV show, we can reduce the number of discs from 5 to 4, say, because we've reduced the size of the files without compromising quality. So that is certainly, I think, one of the most important things I saw at the show was, how are we going to get the bit rate and storage requirements down as much as possible for HD, much less UHD. Mike, you were about to say something?
And then this circles back around to where we were talking at the beginning. All the stuff that the Netflix that's going out there now, remember, is probably 8-bit, 30 frame per second, 420. Right. For the people that correctly would want a 10-bit or a 12-bit or a 16-bit or a 444 and 60 frames, or maybe in the future 120 frames, you're back to breaking the bank again.
Yep, absolutely so. I wanted to make sure we talk a little bit about audio, because there was some audio stuff there at the show. My sort of overarching sense of it was immersive audio. NHK, the Japanese public broadcasting system, was showing, as they have for several years, a 22.2 channel audio system in their 8K theater, which they've also shown for several years. We'll talk about that in a minute. But they also had something that was basically a set of speakers surrounding the frame of a TV that kind of gave you virtual 22.2 sound. And Fraunhofer, it was a German company that developed MP3 to begin with, also had a similar sound frame kind of situation with simulated surround sound around you and immersive. What's your guys' take on that? Mike, let's start with you.
Well, one thing that's also worth mentioning, it's my understanding that the NHK 22.2 system is fixed channels as opposed to object-based, like Dolby Atmos that's in the cinemas now and similar types of things. And
I think Fraunhofer's interactive audio is object-based as well, as I recall.
Fraunhofer, the new DTS, and the Atmos, of course, are object-based. The 22.2 were hard channels, and they all sound good in their own ways, and the production tools are moving towards this. I think it was Avid had a big thing in their booth, now supporting Atmos mixing. But they're all good. Some are better than others at different points, but you got to have one. Or you have to agree that these are the two. Like, we look at what we have now in Blu-ray versus what we have in over-the-air. Over-the-air, it's Dolby Digital or Dolby Digital, or maybe PCM.
Or maybe Dolby Digital.
Or maybe Dolby Digital. But on a Blu-ray, it could be Dolby this, Dolby that, DTS Master, DTS not so master. But at least the players know that they can accommodate them all. And somebody's got to make that decision along the line, or we're going to be chasing our tails.
Yeah, and there is some standards work being done in the object-oriented, or they're calling it the multi-dimensional audio, or I like to refer to it as object-oriented audio, because, again, instead of taking 22 speakers or 240 speakers and giving you this great sound system, that what you can actually do is take the objects and record the objects. And by doing that, some cool things happen. In as we've been discussing with video codecs, we're trying to go for more and more bits, and so much so that we're running up to the limits of the network to be able to deliver them, or the disk to be able to hold them, or the cables to be able to get it from your player to your display. In audio, by looking at the audio as objects, it gives you a couple of really cool things. One is that you can now have objects that you say, this object should go right here, this object should go over here, and you can position it there. And the neat thing is, with the metadata and the object, the sound object, it doesn't take up hardly any space at all, as opposed to trying to encode 22.2 channels of audio. So it's much, much smaller, and it allows the system that plays it back, if you just have two stereo, you know, you have a two-channel stereo, the processor, the DSPs in your AVR can then process that and give you the effect of having, you know, how many ever objects, and trying to place those objects as best as it can for your mm-hmm. playback system.
Except, right. Chris, you've got the same, a different bunch of guys doing the same thing, and they're all playing IP chicken. You could have an open standard so that you can encode it different ways, but, you know, you could probably guess that Dolby would like to see their thing as a standard, so they collect their tribute on every player. DTS would like theirs. Fraunhofer would like theirs. And who's going to say uncle first?
Yeah, well, they're heavy into trying to do this as part of, I think it's ATSC 3.0. They've got a June checkpoint where they're coming in and saying they're trying to everybody have, you know, so DTS and Dolby and Fraunhofer and actually a couple of wildcards are coming in with their proposals for how to do this object-oriented encoding, and they're basically doing a technical shootout, and then let the standards groups try to figure out how to make all that work, you know, with all the lawyers in the room.
I'd love to be the webcam on the wall in that room.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Well, listen, we don't have too much time left, so I want to make sure we talk a little bit about displays. There were some very interesting displays at the show, more for the professional market, certainly, than for the consumer market, but I like to see how that might, or imagine how that might trickle down. For example, a couple of laser projectors, which were pretty cool. Christy showed a laser projector. In fact, two laser projectors, each of which produced slightly different colors of red, green, and blue, giving you the ability to do Dolby 3D, which is where you have to wear glasses in the commercial cinema. But each one filters out three different, slightly different wavelengths of red, green, and blue, giving you the isolated left and right eye images with full brightness, 14 foot Lamberts per eye after it gets through the glasses and everything else using lasers, which I thought was really cool. Did you guys see that demo?
But each the size of a jet ski, it should be noted.
Yeah. Well, the other thing on that too was that the laser part was one of the features of the lasers is that they can be cooled, and because you can link them with fiber, you can put them outside because the cooling system makes so much noise.
Right.
I was in the SMPTE meeting, and we had the projectors up behind us, and it was at times difficult to hear the the speaker over the noise of the, you know, what sounded like a jet running up above you.
Right. Right.
And the Panasonic one was cool, too, where they were spinning the image around.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. The Panasonic laser projector. It was 1080p. It wasn't 4K.
Yes.
As the Christie was, but it was still pretty interesting. One of the most interesting displays to me was the Panasonic 98-inch UHD LED LCD TV with full array backlighting with local dimming. I think we have a picture of that. It's called Panasonic 98, I believe. And for those of you, there it is. And I had a guy stand next to it so you could get a sense of the scale. It's a very big TV. And it outputs a peak white level of 500 nits, which is five times what the current TV standard is. A lot of TVs these days can put out more than 100 nits, which is the current standard. But content is delivered currently to that standard, to a 100 nit peak white brightness, the maximum brightness. And this thing can go five times that high, which gives it the opportunity to do that high dynamic range we were talking about earlier.
Yeah. And one thing with that picture up there, these displays are getting to the point where, you know, you always walk up to the display and you get closer and closer so you can see what's, you know, can I see the pixels? Can I see all of this? And they're starting to get to the point where they feel like you can walk into them.
Right. But
I mean, and walk into the scene.
But there's still the how are you going to get it in the room and how are you going to pay for it, which goes to another trend. And again, albeit not 4K yet, that right across from where that shot is that you just had, Scott, was their short throw projector. And again, admittedly, not quite for consumers, but Sony hinted at a UHD 147-inch short throw at CES. Wasn't it NAB? But I think that was an under-the-table trend.
Well, and we've also talked about all the delivery platforms, and you gotta remember about these guys, because here's, you know, this is now bigger than the screen that's in front of me, okay?
Right.
And I've got more, and I can get more pixels off of this little, you know, palm top than I've got so I can have more pixels in my palm than I can on the wall.
By the way, those of you who are only listening, he's holding up a smartphone. So the second screen experience becomes very important as well. In fact, I got a question here in the chat room a little while ago about that. Let's see. McButterpants asks, how feasible will it be to stream 4K Netflix to a smartphone or iPad?
Well, and I was down in Santa Monica, you know, not too far from you, Scott, a couple months ago, and I was blown away when my friend shows me his T-Mobile iPhone 5 getting 44 megabits a second down in the coffee shop. Okay.
Wow. Yeah, that's
pretty
amazing.
But if you're going to stream a 4K movie, the thing that will be more shocking is when you get the bill at the end of the month.
Well, there's that minor detail.
I also want to make sure that we mention, did you guys see the Red demo? Red Digital Cinema, they make one of the most popular digital cameras that are used in film production. I hate to call it film production, it's movie production. It was used on The Hobbit movies and so on. They just introduced at this show the Red Dragon, which is a 6K camera, 6144 by 3160. There's a photo of it for people who are watching the video. It actually can capture 16 stops of dynamic range, with a frame rate of up to 120 frames per second at 4K or 5K resolution, something on the order of 86 or so at 6K full frame. And as I mentioned earlier, it records in RAW format, which means you can then make anything you want out of it. Now, the demo at NAB I found particularly interesting. They said they actually shot a little short movie on the Red Dragon at 6K. And then they said, well, how are we going to show that at NAB? Because there is no such thing as a 6K digital projector. So they contacted IMAX, and they converted the 6K digital file to IMAX 15-perf 70-millimeter film and had an actual IMAX projector, film projector, in their booth, in their demo theater, showing this content. Did you guys see that?
I have to admit, I didn't wait on the line.
I missed that.
It was a long line, I agree. But I said, I've got to see this. And one thing I will say, I mean, it looked really good, but the black level was so much higher. They preceded it with some digital projection. And I thought the black level looked much better on the digital projection than it did on the IMAX. Could be that the screen was relatively small. I forget what the size was. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a true IMAX screen of 8 stories tall, but it was an interesting kind of reversion or a backwards thing. You know, and usually people like to shoot on film and then it gets translated into digital for showing in the theater. This was going the other way because there was no way to show 6K. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Well, film was commented about several times in the SMPTE presentations. Is like it's an interesting old way of recording video.
And the foot The footnote to Red is that their laser projector was absent for the second year in a row. Scott, you and I saw it 3 years ago now, I guess, and you know they didn't even want to talk about it.
I asked them about it, and they said, "Well, it's on the back burner." So now that we've talked about 6K, we'll end the show with 8K. NHK, the Japanese public broadcasting company, has done for several years. They've shown 8K, and they had a demonstration in another theater showing content that they had shot at 8K, 60 frames per second, on a 350-inch diagonal screen. But what I found fascinating about that was I looked back at the projector, and it was a JVC projector, okay? And so after the demo, I went out and I asked the guy, "So is that a JVC 8K projector?" He said, "No, it's a 4K projector, and they're using E-Shift, which is their technology that kind of splits the pixels in half and kind of jumps back and forth between them very quickly." So I found that fascinating, too, that they were not showing true 8K. Did you guys see that demo?
I did, and I think, as I said to you earlier, I was a little underwhelmed more from the nature of the content. It just didn't show the system off to its best advantage.
Well, they had some stuff from the Sochi Olympics, and they had some stuff from the FIFA, not the World Cup, but the championships, I guess. And, you know, I was pretty impressed.
The documentary was kind of washed out. I think it's just the way the fella shot it. The thing that was impressive was how they've shrunk down the cameras, and where they had those two models with the live displays, the camera size and the fact that it doesn't have 16 fiber links coming out the back. I think that in some respects is significant. And we were talking about compression. They also did a single channel transmission demo where they took the 72 gigabits per second uncompressed data and put it down off the camera into a mere 85 megabits per second. we're worried about 15 for Netflix and 4K, but they crushed it down to 85, and credible.
It was credible. Chris, did you see that demo?
I saw the transmission demo, which looked like it was a repeat from last year, but I did not see the theater. They were only starting every 20 minutes, and it's like I was on a schedule.
Yeah. It was difficult because you had to wait in these long lines to get into some of these demos. Next year, when you guys are there, if you have a press pass, you can sometimes bypass the line, and I'm sorry to those who I bypassed the line in, but I did that a couple times because it was a time-sensitive kind of a thing. Well, listen, we have come to the end of a fabulous hour of talk about NAB. There's so much more to talk about. I wish we could get to it, but, there just isn't enough time. Of course, I made a ton of contacts at the show, and many of the people that I met there and saw there will be guests on this show. So we will continue to talk about what we saw and heard there over the next weeks and months even. But for now, I'm afraid we must say adieu. So thanks very much to both of you. Chris, your website is?
The www.marin-digital.com.
Excellent. And Mike, where can people find you?
Residentialsystems.com and hiddenwires.co.uk or Twitter. I do the Twitter thing, at Captain Vid.
Captain Vid.
All right.
Cool. Thank you both so much.
Good.
So you can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/HTG, and also on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Bob Schuline, who has been a guest on the show before, with news about his immersive audio system. It's Immerse AV, A-V, kind of a clever name, and he's got some updates on that for us. We were talking about immersive audio earlier on this show, so we'll get deeper into that from Bob's perspective. So I do hope you will join me then. Until then, geek out.